just gone nuts. All the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Mr. Check, there's too much paper Bitcoin out there. The price is being suppressed.
Good night, mate. How
do we
doing?
Get out of this? Doing well.
Yeah. Man, I'm just watching red candles and, you know, the market makers, they keep pushing the price down. Coinbase has got nothing on their balance sheet. The whole thing's a scam.
It's a scam. All right, by the end of the year, there's going to be 2,000 Bitcoin treasury companies in public markets. They're going to have 42 million Bitcoin, and the price is going to be at 107K.
My favorite, I replied to you on a tweet just before I went to bed last night. You were talking about Canada's sovereign reserves, and they've got like $350 billion. And you said, you know, imagine having $350 billion of some other country's paper and not buying 3 million Bitcoin. And the first thing that struck me is, guys, we are so big that you can fit a G7 country's sovereign balance sheet into 15% of the circulating supply. And like, just let that sink in for a second. 3 million Bitcoin is Canada's net worth. It's an amazing stat that we're this big. So don't get caught up in all the price suppression. I mean, we're a stone's throw from all-time high. And, you know, the market's absorbing billions of dollars a day. It's bullish as anything.
It really is. And as somebody who's been in it for a while, I like to see the coiling. I like to see the coiling. I like this whole year. Started right before we ended last year. All-time highs, dipped down, came back up, tariff tantrum, back down. Now we're back to 107. You wrote a great newsletter last night, my time, I believe yesterday morning, your time. No, last night, your time.
Last night, my
this
time.
This morning, my time. This morning, my time. I read it on, had a 6 a.m. flight this morning. So read it on the flight. And I think you highlighted a lot of good data on chain that really made me extremely bullish and confirmed my bias towards the coiling. Seems like in the mid to high 90s range, we've got a nice sort of strong base of people that are scooping up coins there. And you're saying we may be at peak HODL, or you're referencing the term peak HODL, the metric peak HODL.
Yes, I tend to, you know, there's always this supply squeeze narrative that floats around. And like, you know, I'm generally one of those folks who's like, guys, supply squeeze is, you know, don't get too caught up on it. But the truth is there are periods of time where there is a supply tightness, right? So I'm not saying supply, same as paper Bitcoin. Paper Bitcoin exists in derivatives, in fraud. There's all sorts of reasons why paper Bitcoin exists. You don't need it as your core thesis to explain why the price isn't higher. You can easily explain it with sell side pressure. That sell side pressure, and this is, I think, what a lot of people miss, it's super bullish. The fact that we've had billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars a day sometimes of serious sell side pressure, and the price is $107,000, that is the signal. So what you're referencing, you can look at, there's a few different ways we can look at it. You look at like short-term holder cost basis, but also I've got these heat maps that basically just look at the UTXO set, give every single price, every single coin or UTXO a price when it last moved. And let's put a density heat map and see where all the coins last transacted. And in that 90 to 100K region, it's a massive, just an absolutely massive band. If you take that realized value, so all of the coins that have last moved, and again, some of them change hands, some of them are in exchange balance sheets, some of them are just some dude transacting, doesn't matter. Don't get too caught up in the details. It actually doesn't matter. When you look at where every coin transacted, 55% of all dollars invested in Bitcoin or held in Bitcoin or saved, however you want to frame it, has a cost basis above 90K. That's insane. That's a super bullish scenario where the market is saying there's a flaw here, right? So the way that I look at that, I don't really want to see the market go below 90K. I don't think that would be a good sign. I think it would take a lot. You'd have to have a pretty major event happen, I think. I don't want to see that. If it does go below 90K, then I'll probably start saying, yeah, something is wrong. And it's probably going to be a global thing, not a Bitcoin thing. But in lieu of that, if we stay above 90K, it's just a huge amount of support there. There's a huge amount of demand. We're seeing demand come in, and like that's where we're at. Don't worry about price suppression. Look at the fact that there is so much demand that we've built this very, very stable floor at 90K. You know, 90K 6 months ago, we're at 70K. So, you know, it's just a whole different animal now.
Yeah, there's a few things here. I think you mentioned it in the letter, and I'm beginning to ask questions, like people DMing me, like, do you think there's paper Bitcoin price suppression? Is BlackRock playing games? And if you look at just looking at HODL waves, it looks like long-term HODLers are selling. And then if you mention that to people, they'll be like, oh, why are the OGs getting out? It's like, they're not getting out. It's like, they've been holding Bitcoin for so long. Their cost basis is so low and they want to treat themselves and say, all right, I'm going to take some off the top at 105K.
And you know why? This is, I think, probably the most important thing, because life is more valuable than your Bitcoins. Your family is more valuable than your Bitcoins. The home that you want to raise your family in is more important than your Bitcoins. You know, Bitcoin's not there to die with. It's, you know, just, I think letting go of this idea that it's some like saintly spiritual thing that you can never sell and it's a sin, like, go and live your life. Not living your life is far worse. Go and enjoy your life. And there's, you know, there's some guys who, like, they want to go and buy a house. They want to pay off their debts. The fact that they're debt free, not everything is about financial returns. And actually, you can almost go the other way and say, by being so fixated on the gains in Bitcoin is a very fiat mindset. Bitcoin buys you opportunity and, you know, time. It gives you time back with the things that really matter. That's what it's worth. That's what it's for. Like, if you're not using it to improve your life and your family's life, what is the point of being here?
Right? And people just can't grok that. So you got to HODL forever. Michael yep. Saylor. We're going to 21 million. Why
if
would you
can
sell?
Get past the HODL forever, that's actually the Bitcoin mentality. You don't get caught up in this fiat gains thing. You know, for example, I talk about this all the time. I don't own gold to outcompete Bitcoin. I own gold because I'm going to sell it in order to get into the housing market. Its job is to not be volatile, but be the same trade. I don't care about the financial gains. I'm not there to make money on it. It's there to be, it's a tool to give me life chips. So it has a very specific purpose. I view Bitcoin in the same way. Its job is that in the long arc of time, it's going to get my kids through a good education. It's going to pay off my debt at some point in time. I'll sit there and let it ride for the next decade. But, you know, it has a purpose to make my life and my family's life better.
Yeah. And so this is talking about OGs selling. And I don't know if you've written about this or been following along, but obviously last year post ETF launch, there was a bunch of 10K filings of institutions, hedge funds, others getting into Bitcoin. Like, how much of any outflows of ETFs could be driven by rebalancing that could be affecting this sell pressure as well?
Yes. So I have actually done a bit of a study on this. So there's a few elements. I ran through a lot of the, it was a couple of, probably a couple of quarters ago, but I looked at all of those 13F filings and basically looked at how much of the ETF flows were institutions. And it more or less aligned with, I think, Eric Balkunas and James Safer to talk about similar numbers, about 20%. And again, this is probably half a year ago, but about 20% of the ETFs appeared to be institutions. The rest was mostly retail. In my initial interpretation of the ETFs, I imagine there's a lot of HODLers out there who finally got a vehicle to put their 401ks in, their, we call it superannuation in Australia, whatever their retirement assets. You know, ETFs are a very good vehicle for that because you've got to do audits and there's all sorts of, you know, every country's got their own system. So I thought retail would naturally gravitate towards the ETFs with that pool of capital, because much the same as what Saylor's doing, going after trapped pools of capital, there's retirement funds that for the first time have now got access easily into Bitcoin. So I think that's a big component. When we look at the, and I actually ran this study, we were talking just before that I was in Seoul for the Bitcoin Seoul conference. And one of my talks at the industry day was all about the how Bitcoin's institutionalizing, what's actually happening under the surface. And one of the charts that I had in there was looking at the weekly inflows and outflows from the ETFs. And what's quite interesting is if you look at the outflows, an average outflow week is about $160 million, which is not small money. But the average inflow week is like 780 million. So it's like a 5x multiple on the outflows. So yeah, we get an outflow of 160 million, but then it's followed by an inflow of 500 million, 700 million, a billion. So the inflows are just so much bigger. And then the other thing you can do is you can overlay CME open interest. And what we've generally seen is that CME open interest will increase as the ETFs get inflows and it will decrease on the outflows. So of those outflows that are occurring, almost always, it's matched almost one for one with CME open interest declining. Now, not all of that is going to be cash and carry, but a lot of it is. And I think just recognizing this is actually not people. Like, there was a big thesis at the start of the ETFs. I think Jim Bianco was a big proponent of it. The ETFs are just an orange poker chip. and all these TradFi guys are going to come and just like, you know, gamble on the market. What's actually happening is that when we get outflows, most of the time it's like structural. It's a hedge fund who's just degrossing and turning off their risk neutral position. So, you know, there's a whole lot of these things. Like, actually, it looks like the ETFs are just hodlers. People are just holding onto these things and we are not getting any sustained periods of outflows. One divergence I have seen, and I haven't fully passed it yet, but it does make sense, is the BlackRock ETF this year. So through most of 2024, BlackRock and Fidelity were always increasing at about the same rate. BlackRock was bigger, but Fidelity was kind of keeping track. Since the start of this year, however, BlackRock is just peeling away, and it has to do with the options, right? I can't think of any other reason why. There's this kind of centralization of liquidity. If you've got the most amount of liquidity in the underlying, then the options are going to be the most liquid. There's not really much reason to trade the second best option market. Everyone wants to trade the best option market. So it actually makes sense that BlackRock's peeling away. But every single other ETF combined is pretty much flat since December in total flows. And BlackRock is just up and to the right. It's more than double Fidelity. It's like $55 billion versus Fidelity's, I think they're like $20 billion in total inflows.
So what does that bring us to totally
in total ETFs, AUM, like it's $135 billion, which is, for last I checked, I asked Grokka a little while back, I think we're 50% of the gold ETF. So you take all the gold ETFs and put them together and we're halfway. Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah. 260 or something.
I mean, it's historically the fastest to this AUM of any ETF launch ever. Oh,
it's kicking ass. It's incredible.
Is a signal in and of itself.
Sup, freaks. This rip of TFTC was brought to you by our good friends at CoinKite. They make the Cold Card Q, my favorite hardware wallet, the most secure hardware wallet on the market. As you can see, it's got the BlackBerry form factor, full keyboard. It's got two secure enclaves. You create your private public keys offline. The device never has to go online, never does go online. So you keep your Bitcoin secure. If you have your Bitcoin on exchanges and you're looking to get it off, secure it in the best way possible. Pick up a Cold Card Q. Go to coinkite.com, find the Cold Card Q, use the code TFTC for 5% off. If you're a power user of Bitcoin, like I am, if you're running a business on a Bitcoin standard, if you're just a Bitcoiner who wants to secure your Bitcoin, get the most secure hardware wallet on the market, go get the Cold Card Q. It's a beautiful thing.
Sup, freaks? Guess what? We launched a browser extension. It's called Opportunity Cost, and it helps you see the true cost of everything in Bitcoin. Convert prices to Bitcoin as you browse the web. Opportunity Cost automatically displays fiat prices in Bitcoin or sats, helping you think in a Bitcoin standard. It works on Amazon, Zillow, X, your bank account, QuickBooks. You can convert everything to Bitcoin. It's really cool. It's also 100% open source, MIT license. We don't collect any data. All of the conversions happen in your browser on your local device. It's a great way to recalibrate your life and begin thinking in sats. Go check it out at opportunitycost.app. That's opportunitycost.app.
And before we get to forward looking, one more sort of a past looking indicator too. World War III. People thought we were going to World War III 2 weeks ago. You had that crash down the high 97s, quickly bought up. And I think that was incredibly bullish for two reasons. One, it highlighted the fact that Bitcoin is a liquidity hedge. When you need liquidity and nothing else is open, if you own Bitcoin, you have liquidity because it's a 24-hour, 7-day a week, 365-day-a-year market. I think it proved that use case. Obviously, there was some risk off going on as the United States was bombing Iran, but Bitcoin was open. People were flying to cash for whatever reason. They went to bolster their balances, and we crashed, but not, I wouldn't even call it a crash. We dipped, and it was quickly bought up.
And interestingly, we haven't seen the bid for Treasury's US dollar. Like, generally speaking, if you were to wind this clock back 2 years, 3 years, and you had the exact same set of headlines, the DXY would be through the roof. And it's not. We're not seeing this, like, flight to US safe haven assets, which is quite interesting. And just as a simple heuristic, whenever your timeline is full of TradFi guys looking at the one-minute chart for Bitcoin saying, look how it's not a hedge, it's usually a good time to actually step in and buy that dip. Because it's hilarious how they'll grab the one-minute chart to look at literally the longest duration asset that exists, which is Bitcoin and gold. And they'll look at these two and be like, see how they're diverging on my charts? Like, bro, zoom out.
Yeah. And look at, yeah, look at U.S. Treasury debt, still around like 4.5% range for the 10-year. And you're thinking about it, if you're an international government or if you're a foreign government looking at the United States Treasury market as a safe haven asset, it's like, is 4.5% over 10 years enough for me? I think you're going to need those yields to go up. And
then you get I saw Trump tweeted yesterday, you know, in as many words, nothing stops this train, right? Basically saying like, we're going to have to monetize this thing at the short end. We're going to put someone in power in the Fed's chair when power goes. We're going to put someone in who's going to be super dovish. He'll lower rates, and then we'll just finance the short end. It's like, oh man, they're just being really, really explicit here that the print's coming. They have no choice. They got to grow their way out is a euphemism for number go up.
Yeah. There's, I didn't dive too deep into this past the headline and the short clip that I watched, but it seems like even Scott Bessent has made like a phase shift in perspective. And I think this morning he was on CNBC or an interview was posted that he did yesterday or earlier this week where he was basically like, yeah, well, we don't have to term out the debt. We can play on the short end. And it was funny because as the Trump administration came into power, they were pointing and laughing and yelling for all the short-term debt that she issued. And now they're like, yeah, we can play in the
front
end.
It just goes to show that they don't have a choice. And I wrote a piece, I think it would have been April. I did a very big, like, I sat down, this is when we were in Bedford. It would have been when we last spoke. And I really tried to get my head around what was going on. And I built this table and it was like these three different games of chicken. There was the US versus China. There was Trump versus the Republicans. And then there was Bessent versus Jay Powell. And I was trying to work out all these different games because someone's going to have to blink in all three of these different games. And like at some point in time, I was like, Trump's going to come up against, he may want to do all the most radical changes in the world. At some point, the Republicans have to get reelected. And it looks like we've just hit that point in time where he's like, you know, you guys have to get reelected. Let's all get on the same page and let's go. You know, we still don't have really a trade deal between the US and China, but I'm not convinced that the US has the strongest negotiating position because China's just the world's factory. And I think there's a lot of challenges there as well. And at some point in time, I think Jay Powell just has to deal with the fact that his boss, the government, has to be financed. And so he's holding out, and you know, I got to give it to Jay Powell, right? He has a very, very difficult job. I don't envy him in the least. And look, you know, again, we can rally all we want against central bankers, given the role that he has and the job that he has to do. I think he got rates to 5%. No one thought he could do this, and he's holding out against a president who's, you know, tweeting, you know, a numbskull every second day. He's doing all right, right? He's got a tough job. I wouldn't want to be him, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I wrote about this last week and was tweeting about it last week as well, but it's crazy the short-termism that exists these days and the amnesia that people have. Like, Trump banging the drum to lower rates. Like, to me, it's like, wait a second. Like, if the economy's not completely imploding, unemployment's not blowing out, inflation is coming down, but it's still higher than the historical target, and interest rates are relatively elevated, like, isn't lowering rates a signal that something's wrong?
And correct.
If you're a president or anybody, just a citizen, a consumer, a business owner in the economy, isn't like higher rates producing a more accurate opportunity cost and cost of capital throughout the economy a good thing that we should want to be able to sustain? Like, why is this? I know why, but I think it's just hilarious psychologically how zerp, zerp, zerp was like a meme. Like, this is a bad thing for the better part of the last 20 years. And all of a sudden now it's like, no, we need zerp. We need zerp again. It's a good thing.
It's being positioned
as a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, the bond market is bigger than Trump. It's bigger than the government. It's the big thing, right? It's the one that calls time. And the bond market, like, they can't finance themselves. The reason they need to lower rates is not because the economy is in a good or a bad shape. It's because the debt's too big, and the number just doesn't make sense. The math don't math when you've got, what is it, $37 trillion now. By the time we talk next, it'll be 38, 39.
Yeah, and I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that if the Fed lowers the Fed fund rate target, that 10-year and 30-year yields are going to go down.
The last time they cut rates, September. The 10-year went up. Yeah, totally. It's a tough position. As Bitcoiners, we've obviously talked about this for a long time. And I mean, I know for me, I mean, again, my background, civil engineering, I knew nothing about the bond market 3, 4, 5 years ago. I had nothing. Now I like, again, I'm not going to pretend that I know, understand how it works, but I know a hell of a lot more than I used to. And I'm just looking at the situation where you're like, they're kind of stuffed, aren't they? And this is why Lynn's meme is just so effective, because no matter which way you want to run right. this calculus, you're like, guys, it's just math. It just doesn't work anymore. You have to print the money. There's just no other way. And then once you reach that conclusion, you realize it's all jawboning. They just have to create narratives. And the thing I find so fascinating is that the market kind of has to go along with a lot of the time. It's a great example of shelling points. So for example, the bond market is supposed to be the smart man in the room. They're supposed to be the market that understands what's going on, and they're trying to judge. It's the big one. And yet they still plug in CPI as their bond, as their inflation number. And we all know CPI is bullshit, but they have to plug it in because every bond trader knows that every other bond trader has their own, they've got their own inflation metric, but every other bond trader is also plugging that in. So the shelling point is, what other number are we going to reference? So they all have to use the same number because they know that everyone else is using the same number. And in order to go out on the risk curve and say, well, I actually think that number's wrong, I'm going to bet against it, you're betting against the mass. And eventually the mass will get there, but it's not an immediate thing. And this is, like, you know, not quite a perfect analogy, but this is why in like The Big Short, they knew the housing market was cooked, but it took years between when they realized that it was cooked and it actually imploding. That period of time, that funding cost, you get wrecked in that middle period. So it's a really interesting thing that, like, simple things like CPI is bogus, and yet everyone has to use it because of a shelling point. I find these dynamics in finance so fascinating.
All right. It's a hard-coded input into all these calculations that totally. Everybody knows it's a bad one, but we got to use it. I'm having visions of Michael Burry going to the whiteboard, or Christian Bale playing Michael Burry going to the whiteboard and writing the losses he was stomaching during that period totally. While he was waiting.
The carry.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm happy you brought up Lynn, because I was there in Vegas when she gave what I thought was the most succinct and clear and distilled version.
It was terrific, wasn't it?
Of her Nothing Stops This Train. And we'll stay on like backward looking stuff for this point. My other favorite presentation at that conference was Saif Adina Moose's presentation on the Tether and the US Treasury market, because here in the United States, looks like we're going to pass the Genius Act, which creates regulatory clarity for stablecoin issuers, and all the politicians and pundits and macro thinkfluencers are saying that we need stablecoin regulation, we need clarity, we need stablecoins to proliferate because they're going to create a lot of demand for our treasury market, which demand is waning right now from traditional buyers, and so we need to bolster up this new buyer. It'll drive significant demand. And I really loved Saif's presentation because it was a real finger in the eye of the sort of the mainstream belief around stablecoin regulatory clarity and what it will do for the treasury market specifically. And just basically just looking at Tether, the biggest stablecoin issuer on the planet by far, and what they're doing. And he basically pointed out, like, the math doesn't math here either. Like,
and very Tether conservative assumptions too. Like, it was like, yeah, Tether like 10x's or something. And
yeah,
you know, the reduction on interest rates is like very, very, it's a strong correlation. It's like, it's just, this is not happening, guys.
No, they're taking those yields and funneling them into Bitcoin. And I really, when you're thinking about like creative thinking and thinking outside the box, like Tether becoming like a Bitcoin stable coin at some point in the future, because they're beginning like their company reserves. And I believe Treasury reserves now, maybe that will change with the Genius Act passing, which I believe for U.S. issuers specifically, they can't have Bitcoin as reserve backing the stable coins that they're issuing. But we know Tether, the company, is separate from Tether's sort of the liquid backing of the tokens themselves.
Yeah, there's the backing of the stable coins, and then there's Tether, the business, who is generating profits from that product.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
exactly.
And stacking a ton of Bitcoin.
Yeah, and gold. What have they got, yeah, like 30 tons or something of gold? It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. No, all this is just to be said, getting back to what we were saying earlier, like, you can't stop this train. Like, it seems like the big print has to come mathematically, any way you look at it.
And then they just have to convince people to, you know, in some narrative, shape, or form, it's okay. That's not what's happening. Don't believe your lying eyes. They just have to convince enough people. Again, that's why I brought up the CPI thing. You just have to convince them enough to just go along with it for another 3 months, and then another 6 months, and then just go along, just another 3 months, which we're almost there. They just massage these people through the journeys. You just debase them through this, and it's going to take a long time to do it, but, you know, there's going to be a suddenly moment when everyone just goes, all right, I'm sick. I'm done with it. I'm done with it. I'm out.
Yeah, I think the Holy Grail narrative sort of framing that they're going with right now is that the productivity gains from AI proliferating are going to be such that we can stomach more inflation because productivity is going to explode exponentially. Okay,
don't worry, it's good for you.
Yes.
It'll be easier.
And it's like, as somebody who's been playing with the tools and leveraging it myself, like, I can totally see that. Like, we've done many things here at TFTC that would not have been possible without going out and hiring somebody, which we're typically conservative about doing, but we've been able to do a lot more with the same team that we've had for the last year, and it certainly has made us more productive. But does that
you also didn't
to...
hire somebody else?
Yes,
like that's the trade-off, right? So
yeah.
Yes, you're more productive internally, but you also didn't hire other people.
Yeah, so that's a big question. But that's what they're going to say. It's like, this productivity is going to be insane. You may not be hiring people, but more people are going to start more businesses. Little side gigs that they can make some money off of.
That's it. Yeah, everyone's doing a vibe coded side project.
Yeah, hey, vibe coding, try it. You may need it just to survive moving forward. They're going to print money. You have these massive productivity tools at your fingertips, and you just got to shoot your shot and try to make some money out there, because AI is coming for your job. If you're an Excel monkey out there, beware.
Well, it's funny, actually. So, I mean, like, one of the many things that I, like, back in 2019, when I was properly falling down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, listening to plenty of your pods, by the way, walking around Regent's Park, listening to you and Matt shill self-custody to me. But in that process, I used to download, CoinMetrics had this CSV with all the original on-chain data, like the very first time you could get data for this stuff. And I used to download it every day, plug it into my I'm an engineer, right? So I use spreadsheets for everything. Plug it into my Excel sheet. And I was like, eventually, I can't keep doing this. This process sucks. Waiting for all your charts to update. Mm-hmm. So that's actually where Check on Chain originated from, is me going, okay, I've got to get off Excel. And it was my excuse to go and learn Python and learn how it all works. And it's still building today, right? Still plugging away. I think it's 250,000 lines or something of code that prints out every day. And yeah, that was my job, to get off Excel. And now, like, aside from the occasional little accounting thing here or there, mm-hmm. everything is Python. I don't touch Excel anymore.
It's a beautiful product, too. Anybody listening should go check it out. It's checkonchain.com, correct?
Checkonchain.com. Oh, I was talking about Excel. But yes, no, Check on Chain is beautiful as well.
Yes.
Serious about your Bitcoin? Start acting like it. Unchained just launched the Financial Freedom Bundle, a curated pack that includes a premium Bitcoin book, a new hardware wallet guide, and access to a private macro event with Tur Demeester, legend. It's time to take control of your generational wealth. Go to unchained.com/TFTC to request yours. That's unchained.com/TFTC. Pretty hot package, freaks. Go pick it up.
All right, moving forward. You're pretty bullish. If I read your newsletter correct this morning on the plane while I was a little groggy, you're pretty excited about what stands before us here.
I mean, I find it hard to look at the price being at 107K, 108K, a support floor below us at 90K, which, again, can it fail? Yes. Do I expect it to? No, not my base case. If it does, then we flip around. But we're in a very, very healthy spot. And, you know, even just simple things like funding rates are like neutral to negative. And I spent a bunch of time last week trying to work out why that is. And there's a few reasons why funding rates could be negative. Lots of cash and carry trade. Generally speaking, if you cash and carry trade, which is where people long spot short the future, if the yield you get from that is at the moment, it's like 2.5% annualized. Just buy a T-bill. What on earth are you doing a complex cash and carry trade to earn half the yield in a risk-free rate? Doesn't make any sense. So it can't be. I'd be very surprised if it's cash and carry. There's relative value trades where people would like go and, you know, short Bitcoin, long shitcoin. I don't see any of that happening, right? I don't see that going on in the crypto world. So really, at the end of the day, there's just like people are just short. People are just like net short, and that appears to be what's going on. So there's a bunch of people who are just net short Bitcoin. And I wrote a piece on it was probably 2 weeks ago or a week and a half ago, called Imagine Being Short. And I literally put myself in the shoes of options and futures traders and tried to work out why they were short. And in the options space, it basically looked like, I think it was out to the end of July, or might have actually been to the end of June. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of put options. Like, people were just like very, very hedged. And someone in my comments actually reminded me that we've got tariffs that start to roll off, or that 90-day pause comes off. And I was like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. So there's a bunch of people. And again, options are a more sophisticated instrument. You're not going to get like your average degen in there who just wants to like gamble poker chips. They're going to be more sophisticated actors. So you're telling me that the guys who are in the sophisticated market are hedged for downside for a very rational reason. When you're hedged for downside, you're not concerned about downside. That's the whole point of hedging. And then you've got in the more degenerate markets, funding rates are basically negative. There's a lot of short interest. When I look at which exchanges it's happening on, yeah, there's some on Binance, there's some on Bybit, there's some on CME, they're the big three. But a lot of it's on these like other, I just put them in the bucket of other, all these exchanges you've never heard of and you don't want to hear of. That's where all the people are short. So I'm like, okay, so I've got the most degenerate traders in the world who are net short. I've got a bunch of sophisticated guys who are hedged for downside because of a very rational reason. Which, where's the max pain here? Probably a down and up. And I wrote a piece called, we've got to go down to go up. And that feels like how it goes. You just go and find this, like tap a little bit of liquidity. We went down to 98K, as you mentioned before, super strong bounce off the top of that support floor I was talking about. So everything makes sense to me. The next level is just go and tag all-time high and grab all those people who are short and going to get liquidated up there. Like, that to me feels like where it wants to go. There's a whole bunch of other elements, right? I mean, long-term holders, they're still selling, but significantly less than usual. So, you know, at the peak in November, December, there was selling like 40,000 Bitcoin per month. Per day, not per month, per day. So there's 40,000 Bitcoin that were older than 6 months coming back to life. And yes, I get this point all the time. Not every coin that transacts is being sold. That's true. But it's very funny that they all seem to transact when the market's ripping to the upside. So it actually doesn't matter where it's 40K or 35K or whatever. It's more than it was yesterday, significantly more. So look at the trend and the direction. There is a lot of old coin that comes back to market when the market rallies. We're not seeing anything quite like that. So really where I sit at the moment, I find it very hard to be bearish. The one thing actually that I think is notably bearish is just the on-chain activity. The blockchain is dead, right? Empty blocks. So that's the one thing I'm looking at going, I don't like that. I would much rather it be full. There's a case to be made that it's because people are punting on treasury companies and all that. But even that is probably not a great sign. That's a speculative signal. So that's really the main area of like, let's be careful. But I just draw a very simple line in the sand. When we're above that short-term cost basis, which is like 98K, you're allowed to be bullish. For me, until we're below the short-term cost basis, you're allowed to be bullish because literally every time we're above it, it's generally bullish. Once you go below it, you've got to flip over, and there's no reason I can see that we should go below that level. We bounced off it earlier. If it goes down to 90K, it's possible, but we need to bounce higher. If we go below 90K, then I've got to flip around and be like, something's very wrong here and I'm wrong. And I'm now going to say, I think we might be in a fairly protracted bear market, but we're a long way from that. So there's a lot of reason to be bullish, and until proven otherwise, I think be a bull.
Be a bull. It's always good advice. And as it pertains to on-chain activity, I agree. It's weird going to mempool.dot space and seeing all these empty blocks. It's almost
very odd.
Be the meme, the guy holding the stick, like do something. And then I think my own Bitcoin users, like I transact in Bitcoin almost every day. And if I'm, and obviously I'm more of a hardcore user, very well versed in the different tools and ways of spending Bitcoin. But if I just look at my own usage, it's probably like 90 to 10% Lightning to on-chain in terms of actually spending.
So you're 90% Lightning, 10% on-chain.
Yes. Like you pay. Interesting, because like
when I look at my footprint, so both myself personally and the business, we're probably like 3 to 5 transactions a month, thereabouts. Depends if we're doing, if we have any sales or something, but like, you know, something in that ballpark. And that's why when I look at the chain, I'm like, okay, if just this one entity, and we're a small entity and, you know, an individual in a business, if we're doing 5 to maybe 10 in a month, that's like my chunk of the block space that I'm consuming. You're telling me that we don't have enough people to kind of fill up at least a couple of blocks here or there. So that's the one area where I'm like, surprising. So we're mostly on chain versus Lightning.
Yeah. Because I wonder, you think about like Steak and Shake, big meme here in the United States. They launched their point of sale Lightning only. If you think of the mobile wallets that most people are onboarding to, Wallet of Satoshi, Speed Wallets, climbing up the ranks after the Steak and Shake launch, which they're running the back end, obviously Strike is custodial, and even, yeah, like in the, I'm thinking of like, if I get a Zapright invoice and I have the option to pay on-chain or Lightning automatically, just because
so here's the interesting faster. Thing, right? Maybe this is a question that we can riff on. Long-term, Lightning and any kind of system that scales, there is the perverse incentive where it actually makes the on-chain security system, because if you have a fee market, right, in a way they work at odds with each other, which is a very interesting dynamic. It's actually why I'm generally supportive of things like covenants, because I think that as you make the on-chain side more useful, and even actually just as a side note, something else to think about, I was on my walk yesterday, if you have things like covenants, thefts are actually harder. So if you're an exchange, the exchange can set up so it has to transact to a specific way. So you actually make this paper Bitcoin thing. You know, if you worry about entities being hacked or stolen or not having the coins or whatever, there's actually more clever ways to ensure that they can't be hacked as easily. So I think that's actually a very promising side to the equation. But as we make the base layer more effective at doing those types of transactions, you can actually start to see more stuff getting built on top. So you almost have to combat the scaling side of Lightning with more functionality. Not, and I'm not saying go and just, you know, plug everything into Bitcoin, but the more you make the Bitcoin base layer useful to have those transactions go down to the base layer, it actually tries to counteract that idea of people just transacting on Lightning. Because when we were in Seoul, I think we went to two or three dinners and we settled via Lightning. And again, there was probably like, I don't know, 15 people. So say 15 transactions on Lightning. And I would say probably three or four of those had to do an on-chain to get onto Lightning beforehand. So, you know, it definitely is going to be a factor in that regard.
Yeah, I've always been a believer of this, is that you can apply Jevons' paradox to UTXOs in terms of you make them more efficient. Covenant's a great example of making a UTXO more efficient. You can do more with it, you get more optionality, and therefore it should drive more demand.
Yes, no, I tend to agree. Fees. I'm quite keen to see how CTV plays out, because obviously we've gone through this as Bitcoiners a couple of times. I wasn't around for the 2017 wars. I bought the top in that market cycle, so I've certainly read about it and understood what happened back then. But Speedy Trial was the first time, I think, first time I saw a full-scale network-wide soft fork. It's going to be very interesting to see how CTV plays out, because there's obviously a lot of support for it, and I think rightfully so. It's a fairly simple upgrade. I'm not going to pretend that I understand it fully on the technical side. I think a lot of this stuff is quite hard to reason about. But there's enough people out there who I certainly value their opinion, and I've listened to their views on it. I'm going to be very curious to see how we approach this as a Bitcoin network, because I think there's been a lot of movement towards the ossification side of the equation, which I think is incorrect. You know, everyone's allowed their own view, but I don't think ossification is the right outcome for now. But it's going to be curious to see how we actually attack this from a soft fork perspective.
I think that's the biggest boogeyman in the room in terms of, I think if you ask most, actually, I won't speak for anybody else. I'll speak for I would love covenants. And CTV specifically, I think it's been out there. I mean, I remember funding lunches for CTV research back in 2018. Like, this is an idea that's been around for quite a bit. It's like the code base has been pretty rock solid in terms of like it is what it is, and there's not much changes to it. And there's been a 5 Bitcoin bounty to find bugs in CTV for I think 2 or 3 years now, maybe even longer, and nothing's been found. And I think covenants, to your point, making exchanges unhackable or individual cold storage somewhat unhackable is a massive benefit. And then when you compare it, I think people have PTSD from Taproot and SegWit, how big of changes they were. And not only that, but the unforeseen consequences of what they enabled when combined with ordinals and inscriptions. And I had James O'Byrne on, who was one of the co-signers of the letter that went out to the core repository that were endorsing the implementation of OpsCTV and CheckSig from Stack together. And when you compare the lines of code, I think CTV is like 200 compared to Taproot and SegWit, which were
mammoth projects.
They were massive. And so, yeah, but it is, I think the boogeyman in the room is like, how do you actually get it implemented if people want it? And when do you start that process? When do you end that process? And I think I do agree with you. I think it's pretty, it's already certain, like ossification is not an option. There are things that need to be changed within Bitcoin if we want it to sustain itself for a century, multiple centuries, potentially millennia. So ossification is already a no-go out the door. I think we need to.
I'm actually quite bullish. Like, again, I don't have any reason aside from just my Bitcoiner instinct, but I'm actually quite bullish that CTV will get activated. And I think we'll find out how we activate things. And strangely enough, I actually was quite encouraged because when they released that letter, it was like at the height of the opportune chaos, right? So Everyone's at each other's throats. We're all arguing over stuff. And by the way, I found that whole experience quite interesting, intellectually stimulating in a way, because again, I don't really have a strong opinion either way. Like I would prefer the scammers would and the spammers would piss off. I fully agree with that. At the same time, I also see where the tech side comes from. It's like, it's kind of hard to stop them. So we can yell and scream at each other all we want, but like probably unlikely stuff changes. I actually kind of like that they launched this letter at the height of that feud, because it was a bit of a, we're not going to be deterred. This is just a good idea. And it's felt very meritocratic. There's a bunch of smart people who've done the work. They've thought about it. They've done the process. They're very confident. They're enough to put a signature down to it. And they launched it irrespective. Like if we had a Bitcoin community that was like, oh, it's too contentious. There's too many people yelling. Let's not do it. It's like, no, fuck that. Let's go. Let's put this letter out there. We think this is a good idea. Don't care what the environment is. And I'm actually quite bullish because of the order of operations in which they issued that letter. I thought that was actually quite indicative that Bitcoin is just going to press on. If it's a good idea, let's do it.
Yeah, it's like, I hope you guys are having fun with that op return battle. Here's another grenade. CTV, here we go.
Yeah, totally. Let's go. But let the free market of ideas fight it out. And it's a very Bitcoiner dynamic. So I was actually quite encouraged by the order of ops there.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I think that was the... I think I'm very much aligned with how you described your perspective on op return, and that was the most disconcerting part of that whole kerfuffle that's still ongoing to a certain degree to me, is that like the conversations around covenants, particularly CTV, were starting to gain momentum, and then that sort of came out of left field. And when it comes to op return, like I think people on both sides of the argument are being a bit childish and
I agree.
Not pragmatic, but it is what it is. Not ideal. I don't like the spammers. I don't like inscriptions. I'm not a big ordinals fan at all. But to your point, like, they're going to do it anyway.
They're going to do it anyway. And I mean, my big takeaway, and I had this opinion when they first came out in 2023, I was like, it's kind of cool that no one could stop this. I'm pretty sure most Bitcoiners are like, this is a scam, this is a spam, and I don't like it. I'm pretty sure most Bitcoiners are there, but I was also like, pretty cool that you can't stop it. Kind of like that there's no like central authority that can just like, yeah, let's turn this off or let's amplify this. Like, you kind of can't do anything about it.
Yeah. To anybody out there, I can hear you typing in the comments right now saying that I need to overthrow Core. We need to replace them. Bitcoin is money. Okay. I don't like it. I think we all just got to be a little bit more pragmatic and understand the reality and the way people are using it, whether we like it or not.
That's it. Oh, that's it. Yeah. Bitcoin is money for enemies, including me and Mr. Reply Guy.
Moving back to what's going to go on through the rest of the year, what are sort of the demand drivers that you see really falling away, picking up, staying where they are, moving forward as we sort of potentially go higher after consolidating at this level?
Yeah, so my general framework here is that, and it's just a reality, every bull market exhausts itself eventually, just the same way that every bear market exhausts itself eventually. Eventually, you just run out of buyers. So how this plays out, so one thing I have documented quite a bit in recent editions, since April, so actually very recent, since April, we've definitely transitioned from what I would call to be a healthy spot-driven market to a less spot-driven, more derivatives, more speculative market. As demonstrated by the fact that the on-chain market is quiet, the market's at 107K, stone's throw from all-time high, Treasury companies are popping up like mushrooms. We've got open interest in futures and options just ripping to all-time highs. I've mentioned this on a few pods recently. I don't know about you, but I've received zero phone calls from normies being like, hey, should I buy Bitcoin? Zero, this whole cycle. In the last like 3 months, many, many existing Bitcoiners have asked me, how would you recommend I lever up? So make of that what you will. That's where we're at. So we're definitely in a more speculative environment. And the way I often look at these things, and you can just look at the way these metrics trade, we are entering the euphoric phase. Now, this is the period in time where things get really exciting. Like stuff really starts to move. We're going to get some of those Omega candles that everyone's looking for. There's going to be some red ones. There's going to be some green ones. There's going to be some periods of time where the market really wants to move. And the narrative will very quickly switch to there is no ceiling, new paradigm, going up forever, Laura. And yes, it is, but there's going to be roundabouts along the way. So how this plays out moving forward is likely to be more volatile. We've actually seen a fairly low volatility environment. My base case is that we actually see volatilities pick up because of liquidations. Leverage is going to start creeping in. You know, people buying all these treasury companies, it's speculation, right? So yes, I agree with the take that it's probably not fair to lump them in with shitcoins and call them the shitcoins of this cycle because, you know, I mean, our business, we're a treasury company. We have Bitcoin in the balance sheet, but, you know, we're a serious business. And I'm not saying any of them aren't serious businesses. It makes sense. Why wouldn't you put Bitcoin on the balance sheet? It's the best asset that we have. So that part of it makes sense. But the behavior of people is a bit shitcoiny, where people want to go and find the next small, you know, you got to get in when they're a small asset and ride them on the 100x multiplier. So the behavior pattern is shitcoiny, speculative. And really, there's nothing wrong with it. It just shows us where we are in the phase of the cycle. And if you think about market cycles and why do bulls eventually exhaust their demand? Because there's only so many people who are going to buy and there's only so much capital that's going to flow in over a defined period of time. And case in point, every single one of us who has a job and a salary, you've got a month worth of pay and then you got to wait for the next month. You literally can't put infinite money in. Every entity has that. Someone only wants to put in a 1% allocation. Someone only wants to put in a 5% allocation. Once they've allocated 5%, they're in. They're in the market. That's it. So there is a limit to how much capital comes in. I'm also of the view that these treasury companies, they're going to be a massive accelerant. It's clear that we've got a very, very large spot bid. The more that the market rewards these companies, the more are going to show up and the more the existing ones are going to buy more. They're as big as the ETFs now in terms of the demand side. So both of those are very, very significant factors. So we have a massive spot bid. We've got long-term holders who are generally speaking backing off. I call it like the lead foot. When I talk about demand and supply, just to simplify things, you've got the demand accelerator and you've got the brake from sell side pressure. The brake is being backed off and the accelerator is going down, right? There's probably only one way the price wants to go. And you've got a bunch of people who are short. Love it. Great combo. But at some point in time, we're going to hit a level where that sell side is going to ramp back up again. You know, 125 is where I expect it to start kicking back in. Once you get higher than that, 150, 160, 170, you're in very, very thin air. We can go there, but historically speaking, the odds get slimmer and slimmer very quickly the higher above 120 you go at the moment. What I think is going to be very interesting, and what I have a view, but I can't predict the future. My base case is that we actually have a cycle top that looks like every other cycle top. No one's going to believe it because they're going to think it's a new paradigm. But what I think is going to break people's head is that the bear market's going to be different. And there's a lot of evidence to say that, like, we've already had two bear markets this cycle in 2024 and then more recently. They kind of look like bears. At the same time, I think the next bear is going to be worse. But we're in this kind of very strange environment where, like, Bitcoin is just not giving back the sell side. We're not getting the depth of these drawdowns that we've seen in the past. They take longer. They take months, not weeks. That's a very big difference, and it leads to a lot of people getting bored, and that boredom creates price suppression claims and paper Bitcoin. But I think that's how this that's my current working thesis, and we'll see how it plays out.
Yeah, I saw you responding to, I'd like you to expand on this, is some, I guess, altcoin trader who was likening the treasury companies to like ICOs, and he was saying, hey, it seems euphoric right now, but trust me, it's only the beginning. And you respond to them saying there is a difference. Like the thing they're holding is already about, like, I can't recall it verbatim off the top of my head, but I'm sure you remember the conversation you're having in that thread. Like, I think that's one question, myself included. Like, I see what's going on with the treasury companies and just pattern recognition alarm bells going off. Like, this seems
rightfully so
very familiar, but there is a difference with the asset that's underlying the strategy, and it's a different pool of capital. So what's your, like, your kind of euphoria?
So it feels very frothy, because I'm 100% aligned with you, where, like, I'm looking around being like, guys, this is like topping behavior 101. But the difference is, and if you think about strategy, when strategy trades at a very big premium, I'm actually more bullish Bitcoin, because strategy's incentive is to sell MSTR, capture the premium, buy BTC. So in theory, there is sell side on the stock, buy side on BTC. So in theory, all of these treasury companies, the bigger their premium, the more buy side for Bitcoin is incoming. Now, the challenge is going to be a lot of people are not going to understand how those premiums work. So let's just, for example, just for simple math, let's just say that strategy is trading at a 2x premium, MNAV of 2. If someone buys MSTR, in theory, MSTR could literally double their treasury and you could make $0. The MNAV could go to 1. And in theory, you bought the stock at $500 and suddenly the Bitcoin balance is twice as big, but you are flat because the MNAV is 1. So people have to remember that if you're buying a treasury company at a premium, you either need that premium to stay the same as a percent or as a component, and the Bitcoin balance gets bigger, so it kind of pushes you up, or you need the premium to expand. This is no different to people looking at, like, price to earnings multiples. Mm-hmm. If a company is trading at a 20x price to earnings, you need the earnings to go up, right, in order to push. It's like this kind of underlying force, or you need multiples to expand. But if the multiples contract and the market is willing to pay less of a premium for future growth, and this is what's going to happen in the next drawdown, the next bear, maybe not the next one, it could be the one after, it could be the next one, there is going to come a time. So do not cloud your judgment and pretend that this is going to go on forever. There will be points in time where people buy the hottest thing as these treasury companies. They'll pay a big premium because the market is growing and they're, you know, they're the only one in their jurisdiction or whatever else. And then what's going to happen is the market's just not going to perform the way that people thought it would, and the premiums will come down. And I think a lot of people will experience 70 to 80% corrections in these treasury companies. I think that's going to be a normal thing. So the way I have been, like, mentally thinking about it and just explaining it, Bitcoin is trading like Bitcoin in 2025. It's a different animal. It's low volatility, low drawdown. Yes, Bitcoin, you can't lose. Like, over any meaningful time frame, Bitcoin's going to kick ass. If you're buying something like Strategy lives in this, like, 2015, 16, 17 type volatility environment. It's like 2x what Bitcoin is. Once you go down to these micro caps, these, like, brand new treasury companies, welcome to Bitcoin in 2011, where an 80% correction happens overnight and you have no idea why. There's no reason for it. There's just not enough liquidity, right? There's just people who come in and out, big orders can move stuff around. There's going to be games where, like, if you're not in the Telegram group that says that this company is about to go through a SPAC and turn into this, and if you're not aware of that in advance, you're not going to catch the initial pump, but it's going to be very, very exciting because you're going to think, oh shit, this is going to be the next Metaplanet. There's going to be some Metaplanets. There's going to be some that, like, there's going to be a Pareto distribution. So just be aware that a lot of these companies, like literally every business venture ever, every startup ever, they're not all run by a Michael Saylor. They're not all going to make it in the same way. And this is very retail money. I can't imagine serious institutions going out and buying the 35th or the 52nd treasury company. I just don't think that's happening. They're going to concentrate in the big pools of capital. So I think there's going to be a handful of standouts. Strategy is just in a whole different world to itself. I think Metaplanet is clearly doing its own thing in Japan. There's a couple of others out there, but, like, generally speaking, you know, my business, we just put Bitcoin on the balance sheet as part of our equity. That's all we do. We keep it really, really simple. A lot of these companies that try to do this growth mechanism, it's good for Bitcoin, but I can't help but feel that a lot of these companies will spit out and puke their coins at the end of the cycle just because they don't have the skill set, the shareholder buy-in, the stones that Saylor has, whatever it is, there'll be a bunch of these companies that do it. Miners have done it every single cycle. We all thought in 2021 that miners would have access to capital markets. Therefore, they would never have to puke out their coins. What happened? They all puked out their coins at the bottom of the bear. So I suspect this will happen again.
Yeah. That's sort of my thinking too. Literally right before we hopped on an hour ago, I had somebody DM me asking, and I haven't responded yet, so if you're out there listening, here's my response. I might text you a response later, but they were like, I just got a lump sum of cash. What do I do? Do I put it in MSTR? Do I put it in Bitcoin? And I'm like, old school, like, nothing better than cold hard UTXOs and cold storage.
That's it.
Like, I'm not going to try and stock pick.
The way I would frame it, if you have to ask that question, the answer is Bitcoin. If you know the answer to that question, go and speculate. If you like if you don't know, because like for me, I've been in Bitcoin for, you know, as I mentioned, finally fell down the rabbit hole properly in 2019. I've seen a couple of cycles. My whole job is analyzing market cycles and Bitcoin data. I'm only in the last like 3-4 months starting to and I'm limiting myself to strategy, really. I don't really care to go that far out in the risk curve. I actually think what strategy is doing is quite fascinating. Going after the bond market, I understand it. I can reason about the product. The product is bonds, and they're tokenizing bonds more or less with a Bitcoin backing. I think it's a fascinating strategy. I did a podcast with Preston, which should be out soon enough, where we just went deep down this rabbit hole. I get it. I understand what strategy is doing. I think it's fascinating. So I want to share in that. Everything else, I'm like, go have fun. Enjoy. I'm going to watch it. I'll analyze it. I'll see them pop up. I'll see them explode. Personally, I'm not interested. I'm very happy with my predominantly BTC. And then, you know, I'll punt here or there because I've been around long enough. If you're asking the question, how do I split this up? The answer is Bitcoin.
Yeah. Keep it simple, stupid. Keep it simple.
Keep it simple, stupid.
Keep your income higher than your expenses. Save some money in Bitcoin.
It's okay to be Squidward in that where he's watching SpongeBob and Patrick playing outside, you know that meme. It's okay to be sitting there watching everyone playing with their treasury companies, because I assure you, it's going to be fantastic for them in this phase of the bull. It's going to suck. It's going to suck for a lot of people because they're going to go too much at the top. They're not going to understand the premiums. And a lot of these companies just frankly don't deserve a premium because most companies don't.
Yeah. All right. Another factor in this cycle that may be different. It's not completely different, but I think with the launch of the lending product at Strike, and particularly Jack's messaging around it, bringing the cost of capital down through their lending desk. I mean, that's another meme that's more predominant this cycle, which is we are going to get lending products to make it extremely easy for you not to have to sell your Bitcoin. Obviously, historically, we've had Unchained, which is down the hall from me right now, led in Genesis famously with their blowups last cycle, but it seems like BlockFi, Celsius named the blowups. But I think the market's learned this lesson on rehypothecation. I know for sure the Strike is very on top of making sure if they're taking people's Bitcoin to lend against it, they're not going to rehypothecate it. And there are many people that are beginning to look at the depth of the liquidity of the market above $2 trillion and see it as an asset that can be used as collateral to get cash to fund a lifestyle without having to sell spot. Is this a factor at all in your calculations?
Yeah, it will become increasingly so. So, I mean, lending against your Bitcoin makes all the sense in the world. Like, it's pristine collateral. Why wouldn't you? So for me personally, and I'm only going to speak for myself, I have definitely looked at it. And right now, as it stands, a lot of them are fairly hefty interest rates, 12%, something of that ballpark, and 12-month terms. Now, there's obviously then another layer, and I think actually, I forget the name of the website, but Hugo from Nunchuck, I think he was involved. They've got a 21-something. There's a website that shows where they've kind of rated all these different entities. I thought that was quite useful, and I think for me, I'm going to allow this to play out for one more cycle. I'm in no need to go and tap that liquidity just yet. I'm actually okay to just allow the competition to build, allow the rates to come down. I think what strategy is doing, we're seeing in the TradFi world, they're normalizing Bitcoin as a collateral. So I think that once the market gets more comfortable, so this is what I would call the early adopter phase. You're right, we had like the cowboy phase with Genesis and all that last cycle. We're now in the early adopter phase. I kind of look at like, what am I going to do to, you know, you borrow $100,000 and you have to pay it back in 12 months. Like for me, I want to, if I'm going to borrow money, it's to get into the housing market. And that's just like, you know, that's just not really a feasible approach. So for me, I'm just going to allow the market to find its level. There'll be a lot of people who do it. I've had this question actually from a lot of people saying, hey, you know, how do I risk manage these kind of things? It's like, if you're asking those questions, it's probably a bit early for to be thinking about it, right? So you should be in the market long enough and understand your financial position enough that you shouldn't be questioning what LTV is, and you should know. You should be able to work this out. If you're still, again, this stuff isn't easy, but go through the loops of trying to work it out yourself, model it out, and never, ever assume the Bitcoin price cannot go to a certain level. And I'll tell my story. I learned this lesson trading options back in 2019, 2020. I thought I was hot shit. I've discovered the realized price. I've worked out how on-chain data works. I'm teaching people about it. I thought I was a genius. And I've learned about options. And I was selling puts below the realized price of 6K. And my thesis was, we're never going to go below 6K again. March 2020 comes, straight through that level, literally liquidated me by like 2%,
6 hours.
Took my whole account straight back up, and then next thing you know, we go to 60K. So I would have made all my money. I would have made it all if I just hadn't have thought the price can never go back to this level. So, you know, when you're thinking about LTVs on this stuff, never ever believe anyone telling you the price cannot go to a certain level. I often say the odds of it going back to 40K and undoing the ETFs, in my opinion, is like slim to none. I do not factor in these, not even in my cases. But I would never, ever settle loan on the assumption that it can't happen. So just be aware of that. I think it's going to build up over time. I think in 2, 3, 4, 5 years' time, this industry is going to be booming because it makes all the sense in the world. And especially with like Saab 121, once the banks get involved, and I know this is another, you know, Bitcoiners are going to say, oh, don't give your Bitcoin to the bank. It's like, you use Bitcoin to do whatever you need to do to make your life better. Don't listen to anyone else tell you what to do with your savings. You do whatever you want with your savings. Certainly listen to heed the warnings, right? If you're putting your coins into a bank, you are giving up self-custody. But for me, I'm going to sit there with my UTXOs for now, let this market play out, find the level, wait for the rates to come down, wait for the terms to go out, wait for the market to get more accustomed for Bitcoin as a collateral asset. It will happen. I'm just going to be patient and wait for it.
Yeah, I'll add some other pieces of advice there. If you're going to take out a loan, do not put your whole stack in a loan. Number two, and I'm going to bring this up again. I brought it up in Rabbit Hole Recap a few weeks ago, but it seems to be a question in people's minds. I was at a meetup in Philadelphia and somebody asked, when's a good time to take out a loan when the price is low and the price is high? When the price is low, that's when you want to take out the loan if you're going to do it.
Yes. When it's the price scary.
Yes. If it gets above a certain level and you're thinking about it, it may be too late.
That 100%. I mentioned before, I've had a bunch of people saying, hey, what's the best way to lever up? I've had some questions like, what's the best price to, well, like, where should we lever up? I was like, probably at 20K when FTX blew up. That's probably the best time to have levered up. 110K when like there's speculation coming out everywhere and, you know, futures open interest is at all time high and people are levering up. Not really the, like, you can do it, but be prepared to ride the wave because it's going to be a wave.
Yes, it is. That said, we're talking to Check the Analyst. We have been very level-headed, sober. Says things that not many people want. People want the moon juice. And to pull that out of you, what would have to change from like a market structure, sentiment, psychology, sort of demand drivers in the market for this to get weird in your mind?
Very good question. So this is more from Check the Hodler's perspective, right? When the things get a bit Looney Tunes. I mean, I just look at the price pattern. Like look at the monthly chart. It's incredible stair-stepping pattern. Where the hell are the drawdowns? I can't for the life of me put myself in the mindset of someone who's saying this cycle sucks. I look at this cycle, I'm like, it is unbelievable how much capital is coming in, how little the drawdowns are. And I've been using this analogy or this kind of anecdote from my old man. My old man bought in 2020, which means he went through the up of 2021 and he went through the down of 2022. And let me assure you, I heard all about it all the time. When number go up, mate? When is my number going to go back up? Now He closes every sentence with number go up, love it. That's where he's at. So like, think about the pools of capital who are now going to look at this price chart and be like, yeah, I'll allocate. Why not? I should actually take 5%. It looks like it's no longer volatile. It looks like it doesn't do those, you know, crazy things. And I don't see it going down anymore. It seems to go up. Hey, I'm waiting for a dip and I'd love to buy in. All of these things, you just got to think about the pools of money who the lower vol that we're seeing at the moment is going to be much more tempting for. So, and I've heard this from many people. People are getting calls from investment managers and retirement funds and family offices who are like, all right, it's time. I want to put a 5%. You mentioned, I think, I can't remember if it was on the air or not. There was like an IRA bloke who came out and said like 20 to 40%. Like, guys, the amount of money that is about to start allocating to risk-free Bitcoin is astronomical. Like, we can't actually think about how big, the numbers are massive. And actually, I ran a study a little while back. I was trying to just put things in perspective of, you know, for how big Bitcoin is. If you look at the capital inflows into BTC, whether it's via ETFs or treasury companies or whatever, over the last 30 days, it's about $36 billion a month. That's the rate of change, $36 billion. The Bitcoin market cap in May 2017 was $36 billion. So everything up until May 2017, we absorbed in 1 month. If you take the ETFs and strategy and put them together, the market cap combined of those two is like 2 days before the 2017 all-time high. So literally everything up to 20K is in the ETFs and your strategy's balance sheet, which really both of those have grown up over the last, like, you know, really, let's say 18 months. The ETFs are 18 months. Strategy bought the most over the last like 6-7 months. So guys, like, old history doesn't matter anymore. Like, all those previous cycles, they're irrelevant. They're like a footnote of behavior. They don't count. We are in a new paradigm. We are in a new paradigm. And what it looks like is stair-stepping, right? This slow, boring-ass grind. I think Joe Calasari said this. We're in like a slow, boring-ass grind to $1 million, and we're going to be price-suppressed the whole way up. Stop being bored, guys. Be bullish. It's fucking bullish. Get excited.
Yeah, we're going to be 200K and be like, there's paper Bitcoin out there.
There's suppressed. I know. There's so much paper. Why aren't we at 2 million? We should be at 2 million. We should be higher.
Yeah. And if the other thing we can focus on, what's happening in terms of demand drivers internally within the Bitcoin market, whether it's ETFs, treasury companies, structured credit products coming to market, then like going back to what we were talking about earlier, like, is there a big print? And if so, how big, how fast, and what does that mean for inflows into Bitcoin?
Exactly. And sorry, just something that clicked to me before. I wrote a piece that I called Paper Bitcoin, trying to address this topic. I mentioned before that BlackRock is tearing away from the other ETFs. That is real Bitcoin going into those ETFs. Why are they doing it? Because of the options market. In order to take advantage of the derivatives, people can now allocate to the asset in the first place. So the growing up of derivatives allows bigger money to come in. This is why BlackRock's peeling away. So it's just great evidence that, like, just because you have paper Bitcoin in the system being derivatives, that actually enables a lot of these big entities to allocate when they previously couldn't because they can hedge risk. So I think that's just a really, really important thing to pay attention to. I missed your question before, actually. What did you say before that?
No, so it wasn't even a question. It was a statement. I'm just, how big is the big print if it comes?
Oh, yeah.
How long does it last? And what is it, I mean, in terms of, like, market structure changing moving forward? Like, how much effect does that have?
We went from 36 to 37 trillion. Like, yeah. I remember people talking about 36 trillion, then like next thing it's like 37. It's probably like halfway to 38 by this point. Like, I mean, they don't have a choice. So just like grit your teeth and sit tight.
I really don't. Send it on turbo, as Elon said before he left Doge.
That's
his hands.
And that's another great example, right? Well, they go in saying they're going to cut 1 trillion, 2 trillion, they got 150, and then he got kicked out. It's like the beast
out.
Is too big.
Got kicked out saying that Trump's on the Epstein list as he's walking out the door. It's chaos. It's beautiful chaos, though. I think despite whatever happens, whether it's within Bitcoin, treasury companies going crazy, ETFs going crazy, RIAs aping in externally, Elon saying that Trump's on the Epstein list, World War III fears, UFO fears. Who knows what's going to pop? Just blinders on. Stay focused. Keep stacking Bitcoin. Don't get over levered. Don't get crazy. Just focus
on it. Stay humble. Stack sets. Yes. Yes, it's just that not that difficult. That is the best advice. It has to go. I mean, it's going to compete forever with Nothing Stops These Trainers, the two like quintessential Bitcoin memes. If you just listen to those two little phrases, you're going to be just fine.
Well, it's funny. It's not that hard, but it's very hard for a lot of people who haven't internalized.
Well, it's simple, but it's not easy. Yes. I think that's a really important element. And I actually wrote about this in the piece you were talking about before, P. Cottle. I opened by saying, like, why do I actually write any of this stuff? It's to just help people not feel like a deer in the headlights, because hodling is simple. It is a very, very simple strategy, but it is really, really difficult because the world keeps telling you that you're wrong. We keep getting crazy headlines. Every influence in the world wants to shill you why their thesis as to why the market's up or down is better. Like, at the end of the day, you just have to stay humble, stack sats, and just trust the process. This is just trust the process.
Yeah. It's funny because you have the TradFi incumbents who hate Bitcoin saying it's going to zero, and then on the other side you have those far out on the risk curve within Bitcoin, like aping into all these treasury companies and levering up, whatever it may be, saying, "Oh, you're going to miss out. You're not levered up enough." And then you're in the middle, like, "Wait a second, it's like smash buying and moving to cold storage. That's not good enough." And
because every treasury company still has to buy the Bitcoin as well, we're all in the same trade there. And I'm just going, like, at the end of the day, you're selling the stock and buying the coin. I'm just buying the coin. I'm just going to skip the middleman of buying the stock. Who's going to buy the coin? Just buy the coin.
Just buy the coin. James, it's always a pleasure, sir. Thank you for doing what you do.
Good to be back on.
We'll have to do this again. Maybe we'll catch like peak euphoria at the end of the summer, beginning of fall. We'll be catching up then.
Yes. When we enter the topping cloud and things start to get really exciting, we can definitely do an ad hoc episode.
I have a feeling we're going to do an episode. People are going to be like, "Oh, James is too bearish. It's a super cycle." And then something's going to happen. It'll be a super cycle.
No. I'll have a very rational, sound view.
You're going to be on
evidence
here
as to why it's over. And it's just going to keep going forever. That's how this plays out.
That's the best way it could play out.
Right? Yeah, totally. And that's the other thing, right? In a way, by being very rational, if it keeps going, I win. If it doesn't, then at least I'm like aware and prepared for it if it doesn't go the way that the moon boys think. So, you know, again, it's all about managing your psychology, because at the end of the day, you're the only one that can manage your Bitcoin and how you deal with market cycles. It's actually a mental game. Don't worry about it as a financial game. It's a mental game. And that's what getting a reasonable take on things, that's what I do. That's why I write and why I do the analysis. It helps me stay grounded, so that when stuff doesn't play out the way the moon boys said or the doomers said, it kind of goes down the middle. I'm like, "Oh yeah, makes sense actually."
Yeah, check the rational analysts. You actually win bigger because you're prepared to buy the dip when it materializes. You're not over-levered.
And the rip, you're not surprised when it happens.
No. All right, you go enjoy your Tuesday. Thank you for hopping on, and keep writing the newsletter. I love it. If you guys haven't checked the substack.checkonchain.com.
I just go to checkonchain.com. You can't miss it.
All right, it's there. Go check it out. Peace and love, freaks.
Okay.
Freaks, thank you for listening to the show. I hope you liked it. If you did like it, please make sure you subscribe, rate, review the show. It helps us out a lot. And also, if you like these conversations, I've come to realize that many people listen to the podcast. They don't know we have another sort of layer of this media company. We have the newsletter, the Bitcoin Brief. Go to tftc.io. Make sure you subscribe there. A lot of the topics that are discussed on this podcast, I write about 5 days a week in the newsletter. We also have the TFTC Elite tier. If you sign up for that, become a member. We have a private Discord server for the elite freaks out there, where we're dropping ad-free versions of this show and having discussions about everything we talk about a day early. Logan wanted me to make sure, if you want to get the show a day early, become a TFTC Elite member, you will get that. We have our Discord server. Right now it's conversation between myself and TFTC Elite tier members, but we're going to expand that. We'll probably do closed Q&As with people in the industry. I may be doing Macro Mondays. So join us. Go to tftc.io. Subscribe. Find the button in the top right corner of the website. Become a TFTC Elite member. Thank you for joining us.
Okay.